This is the second day of this June 2018 7-day Sesshin. We'll return to our text, teachings of Chinese Zen master Daikaku. That's his Japanese name. I'm reading from a book called The Original Face, an anthology of Rinzai Zen. And this is it's called Zen Master Daikaku's Treatise on Sitting Meditation. It's in the question and answer form. Question. Lead up to this, Daikaku is emphasizing the simplicity and the completeness of Zen meditation, and that it's not necessary to add lots of other kinds of practices. Question. Though I hear what you say, it's still hard to really believe. Only by accumulating the virtues of reading and reciting sutras and dharani, fasting, discipline, and the recitation of Buddha names can we have something to rely on. How can there be anything special about peaceful meditation without doing anything? And Daikaku's reply, such doubt is called activity causing birth and death. Such doubt is called affliction. Practicing everything without any sense of attainment is called the exceedingly profound transcendent wisdom. This wisdom can cut off the source of birth and death like a sharp sword. Just to pause here, twice now in this paragraph, he's used this phrase, birth and death. It's important to understand this is really just the world of change, in particular the world of loss, the world of suffering. So every time you hear in these texts, I think it's, both Chinese and Japanese texts, you hear this phrase, birth and death, just think of change, loss, suffering. This wisdom can cut off the source of birth and death like a sharp sword. That is, this wisdom, practicing everything without any sense of attainment, is called the exceedingly profound transcendent wisdom. Without any sense of attainment, this is very pure, pure form of Zazen. Because for most people, most of the time, in the back of the mind, there is this wanting to get something out of it. And that's what contaminates our efforts. We're using the practice as a means to an end. And it's not that there aren't benefits from that. Surely there are. But it's not the purest, the true Zazen, which is where there's no thoughts of attainment. He continues, to practice virtue in hopes of reward is the illusion of ordinary people. Bodhisattvas do not seek for the resulting rewards as they cultivate roots of virtue because they cultivate goodness for the sake of impartial love and compassion, and thus it becomes sustenance for enlightenment. And for those who seek rewards as they cultivate virtue and attain the lesser reward of humanity or godhood, this is surely the work of birth and death. That last sentence, those who seek rewards as they cultivate virtue attain the lesser reward of humanity or godhood. We mentioned yesterday these are the two highest of the six realms of unenlightened existence, that of human beings and gods or devas. And so doing good things, doing good deeds, does lift us out of the four lower realms of unenlightened existence to these upper two, the realm of humans and gods. But there's no security in that until we have seen through this life of conditioned karma, through awakening, then we are always susceptible to dropping again into the lower realms of unenlightened existence. So it's awakening that lifts us out of those six realms, even above the realms of humans and gods. Just to read this sentence again, bodhisattvas, and bodhisattvas could say in the broadest sense, all of us are bodhisattvas to the extent that we are practicing in order to help others. If that is our motivation, bodhisattvas do not seek for rewards as they cultivate roots of virtue, because they cultivate goodness for the sake of impartial love and compassion, and thus it becomes sustenance for enlightenment. In other words, cultivating virtue or doing good, not out of self-interest, but out of compassion. There's a passage I found in my file by a Chinese master called Li Tongxuan. It's in a commentary he did on the Avatamsaka Sutra. Avatamsaka Sutra is the primary sutra of the Kagon, or the flower garland sect, the Huayan sect of Buddhism. It's not Zen, strictly speaking. It's got a lot of overlap with Zen, but it's a different sect. But it speaks right to what Daikaku just said here. This is what this Li Tongxuan says in his commentary. Since the aspiration to enlightenment is not learned or cultivated, the aspiration to enlightenment is always clearly self-evident as long as we carry out enlightening practices to quell habit energy. Let me pause here. This is if we understand the aspiration to enlightenment correctly as a kind of a basic wiring we have to evolve. That this aspiration doesn't need to be even a thought so much. Sometimes the term is bodhicitta. Sometimes translators render it as the thought of enlightenment, but I think the aspiration to enlightenment is more clear. It's something deep, deep within us that drives our practice and not only those practicing the Dharma. Roshi Kapo used to talk about it as a vow, this vow that we took eons and eons ago. It's the same vow that an acorn takes to become an oak tree, a peach stone takes to become a peach or a peach tree, and the same vow that a newborn infant takes to become fully grown. It's something beyond our conscious will. It's because that's our nature. This is our true nature we're talking about. Our enlightened nature always wants to realize itself. So just to reread that first paragraph, since the aspiration to enlightenment is not learned or cultivated, the aspiration to enlightenment is always clearly self-evident as long as we carry out enlightening practices to quell habit energy. So there, the emphasis on practicing enlightening activity. He says, it is as when clouds disperse in the sky. The sky itself is clear, so there is no further search for clear sky. And then his advice, just carry out the myriad practices of compassion and wisdom as means of stabilizing enlightenment. If any practice is not carried out, then there is an obstacle, and so the aspiration to enlightenment is not in its complete state, since enlightening action is itself the aspiration to enlightenment. Very important point here. We don't need to be thinking about enlightenment. The important thing is to enact or to embody the aspiration to enlightenment, and that comes through enlightening activity. And what is enlightening activity? Well, there's a formula that we all know. It's called the precepts. Means not killing, not stealing, not misusing sexuality, not lying, not abusing alcohol or drugs. Not speaking of the faults of others, not praising myself and disparaging others, not indulging in anger, not withholding spiritual material aid, and not reviling the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So the path is clear as far as how we need to conduct ourselves. And the more we can cleave to that formula of the precepts, the more we are embodying this enlightened nature that we all have in common. And then this commentator ends by saying, so once Sudana had awakened the aspiration to enlightenment, he asked Manjusri how to learn to act as an enlightening being and practice the path of enlightening beings. He asked no more about the aspiration to enlightenment. And even after an experience of awakening or enlightenment, the key thing is to embody it, to make it real in one's daily life. In a way, it makes no sense to talk about an enlightened person because there's no person there. There's no self. It's in the daily living up to enlightening activity that everything depends. So rather than speaking of enlightened persons, it's better to speak of enlightened conduct, enlightened activity. And that's something that anyone can do. I'm suddenly reminded of the parable of the prodigal son, the Buddhist version of that, where the king had a son, the apparent heir to the throne, and his son wandered off out of the palace grounds and disappeared, and ended up with very common people, ragged beggars. And one day his begging rounds happened to take him in front of the palace gates, and his father recognized him as his son, but being a wise king, a very wise king, he didn't rush out and say, my son, all these years, where have you been? Please come back. He recognized that his son would not be able to process that shocking truth. And so the king invited his son, the beggar, in and gave him a job on the grounds, landscaping, something like that. And then patiently he observed his son, saw how hard he worked, and promoted him little by little until he had grown into his true self. And then he revealed that he was the heir. We're all the heirs. Every one of us is the heir to this fortune of our essential nature. And Sesshin is a way of purifying the obstructions that get in the way of us living in accordance with our enlightened nature. Little by little, usually it's little by little, we grow into who we really are, our true self. Back to our text. Question. Without accumulating virtue and good qualities, how can one become a Buddha in whom myriad virtues are complete? Daikaku, it takes three incalculable eons to attain Buddhahood by accumulating virtue and good qualities. But if you practice the way of unity, of cause and effect, you realize Buddhahood in one lifetime. The unity of cause and effect. There's a line in the Hakuin chant that we recite each day. Then the gate to the oneness of cause and effect is thrown open. The way of unity of cause and effect is Zazen. Sitting and moving Zen practice. We're simply one with what we're doing. There's no thought of this as a cause for a future effect or this as the effect of a previous cause. There's just complete absorption in what we're doing. And ultimately, beyond thought. This is the unity of cause and effect. He says if you practice this, you realize Buddhahood in one lifetime. Someone who illumines his own mind and awakens to his true nature sees that he himself is originally Buddha, not now attaining Buddhahood for the first time. Again, this word Buddha, remember, it always means enlightenment. She sees that she herself is originally enlightened, not attaining enlightenment for the first time. couldn't be more different from the doctrine of original sin. Question, do those who realize Buddhahood means enlightenment, or probably full enlightenment is what Buddhahood means, do those who realize Buddhahood by seeing reality not depend on cause and effect? Should they not cultivate virtue? Daikaku, although those who realize Buddhahood by seeing their true nature may cultivate virtue, they do it for others' benefit, not for rewards. Because they teach and transform sentient beings, they teach cause and effect. So they teach it because it is a fundamental law of causation. Because they know they have no personal gain, they do not depend on merit. They have no mind at all. That is, no mind of self-interest, of calculating and planning. This is a crucial, crucial milestone in practice when we realize that we want to realize the practice we're working on. We want to resolve, say, the koan for others' sake. It's when we recognize once we've at least, even to a small degree, seen through the illusory nature of self and other, once we've done that, we are better positioned to help others. We're purified to an extent, and in that sense are better able to serve others purely rather than just as something that'll have better image of ourself. How many do-gooders, let's say, how many do-gooders don't have in the back of their mind the need to preserve this image of themselves as good people? Or to put it another way, how many people who are serving others, doing good for others, do so purely for the sake of others? Maybe rare. And if there is one's own agenda that's driving this service, social service, or helping others, then we're always a bit vulnerable. There's something a little bit contaminated about what we're doing. There's a degree of attachment. We're attached to the image of ourself as a giving, noble person, and that is always possibly will trip us up if the person doesn't respond the way we want them to, if we don't get the results that we want. So Daikaku finished there mentioning no mind. And so the questioner, what is no mind? If there is no mind at all, who sees reality? Who awakens to the way? And who can expound the way to teach? Yeah. Good questions. And if the questioner ask those questions sincerely, purely, she would go quite far. But Daikaku responds in his own way. No mind means that there is no deluded, foolish mind. It does not mean that there is no mind to discern false from true. If one doesn't think of sentient beings, sentient beings is just the way in the Buddhist texts that you refer to unenlightened beings. If one doesn't think of sentient beings, doesn't long for Buddhas either, in other words, not caught in this dichotomy between the enlightened and the unenlightened, doesn't think of illusion or seek enlightenment, doesn't go along with the honor of others, does not hope for fame, profit, support, or reputation, does not shrink from attacks from those who are resentful or hostile, and does not add any discriminating thoughts about any good or evil, one is called a no-minded wayfarer. Or let's just make it no-minded. No-minded, in other words, means a mind that is not marred by concepts of any kind, really. But he just mentioned some of the most common conceptual traps. And then the questioner goes back to the various kinds of secondary practices, upholding the precepts, reading, reciting sutras, and so forth. He said, okay, I get the virtue of those things. He says, but what is the virtue of no-mindedness? And Daikaku replies, all roots of virtue and good qualities are conditional, whether they be heavenly or humanly mundane. That's, again, we're back to the two highest realms of unenlightened existence, heavenly and human. No mind is immediate witness of the path of enlightenment, so its merit cannot be adequately expressed in words. Really, it is the condition of the one great matter. The afflictions of birth and death die away of themselves. Mind and body are one thusness. This is what it is. Everyone here in Sesshin, everyone has the chance this week, if you haven't already this week, of reaching this state of no mind. Being free of thoughts and concepts. The mind is just pure, unscored. One. It's a difficult state to abide in, so usually we get little glimpses first before we're able to abide in the state longer. But it's right here. It's open to everybody. As long as we're not aiming to reach that state, but are simply absorbed in the practice we're working on. Since this enlightened nature is common to all of us, in all periods of time, all centuries, and all cultures, it's not surprising that there are statements that we come across now and then that suggest that the writer has an experience with this in this realm of no mind or true mind. Three of the Westerners who seem, if they weren't enlightened, they sure talked a good game. They expressed the mind of the no mind of enlightenment. One of them is Walt Whitman, another two that come to mind are Abraham Lincoln. I don't know. I've never even read a single biography of Abraham Lincoln, so I wouldn't venture to comment on that. But Abraham Lincoln and Rainer Maria Rilke. And then we have our own Walt Whitman. This is a passage that suggests that he had some experience with the Dharma, even though he'd never heard of the word Dharma. He said, "There is something that comes to one now and perpetually. It is not what is printed, preached, discussed. It eludes discussing in print. It is not to be put in a book. It is not in this book. It is for you, whoever you are. It is no farther from you than your hearing and sight are from you. It is hinted by nearest, commonest, readiest. It is ever provoked by them." This is from his Leaves of Grass. This last line is especially Zen-like in how concrete, physical it is, that this mind, this no mind, is hinted by the nearest, the commonest, the readiest cushions, blankets, cup of tea, soap in your hands when you're washing your hands. It is ever provoked by them. Question. The sutras do not speak of no mind, nor do they praise it. By what school of teaching do you esteem this? So the questioner still looking for some kind of scriptural legitimacy, grounding in this. But Daikaku says, various sutras have not failed to speak of it. Some say, the path of words ends. Some say, it cannot be explained, or ultimate emptiness, or the condition of the one great matter. And also they say that all things are quiescent. Shakyamuni shut his room. Vimalakirti closed his mouth. Does this not point to no mind? Continues, although there are 84,000 entrances to the truth in the teachings, that's some kind of old formula, I don't know what it refers to, they do not go beyond form and emptiness. Everything that has form and characteristics is matter, body. That which does not show any form is all empty. Because the body has form, it is called material, and because the mind is formless, it is called empty. None of the sutras goes beyond these two things, form and emptiness. I would also say no koan is beyond those two concepts, form and emptiness. Every koan, in its own way, is pointing to the interpenetration of form and emptiness. They can't explain the sphere of no mind, so they don't extol this matter. Because words cannot reach it, it is called the special transmission outside of doctrine. That's a traditional way of referring to the Zen school, the special transmission outside of words and letters without reliance on the sutras. I have to take issue with this dualistic way. In these couple sentences, he says everything that has form and characteristics is matter body. That which does not show any form is all empty. As if you can separate form and emptiness. Have to wonder not about his understanding, but about the translation, maybe. But as it is, it's an incomplete statement to discriminate the so-called formless from that the world of matter. Question, is this body then to be considered illusion? Can it be considered enlightenment? And what is the mind? The basis of illusion and enlightenment, it should be known. And is the mind inside the body or outside the body? Where does it come from? And then daikaku, the body of four gross elements, and by that he means the traditional structure of fire, water, earth, and air, four gross elements and five clusters, or skandhas. We say this word, skandhas, every time we chant the Prajnaparamita. The five skandhas are form, feeling, thought, choice, consciousness. All this fills the universe. All sentient beings are the foundation. Causes and conditions interact to form physical bodies. This is called birth. When the results of the causes and conditions change and die out, then the four elements disperse. This is called death. In form and characteristics, there are ordinary people and awakened ones. In the essence of mind, there is no delusion or enlightenment. So he's distinguishing between things seen from the world of and as the world of appearances, and distinguishing that from the essential matter, neither delusion nor enlightenment. Even so, we provisionally define the deluded as sentient beings and the enlightened as the Buddhas. But delusion and enlightenment are just creations of the deceiving mind. In the real mind, there is no illusion or enlightenment. And we can go further and say, there's no distinction of real mind and unreal mind, ultimately. Question, if there is fundamentally no illusion in the nature of mind, that is the fundamental nature of mind, where do illusions come from? Daikaku. When false thoughts arise, illusion comes along. And because of illusion, afflictions are born. When errant thoughts cease, then illusion goes, and when illusion goes away, afflictions also die out. Afflictions are things of life, seeds of birth and death. Enlightenment is the way to extinction, that is, what is beyond afflictions. If you take peace and quiet to be bliss, all things are afflictions. But when you are enlightened, all things are enlightenment, or the functioning of mind, enlightened mind. People of the world do not understand this basis of delusion and enlightenment. They suppress thoughts of birth and death and think that this is the non-birth of a single thought. and also consider this no-mindedness. But these are still thoughts of birth and death, not no-mindedness, not quiescence. When you try to stop thought by thought, birth and death continue. So he's addressing here what apparently was a problem in his time. They were talking about the 13th century, where there must have been practices where you could, just through willpower, suppress thoughts. And he's pointing out that that's not really anything that we want to strive for. We want to see through thoughts, see the illusory nature of thoughts, not try to suppress them, or stamp them out, or stop them. That's the biggest mistake in Zazen, is trying to stop your thoughts. Well, our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four Bodhisattva vows. All beings without number, I vow to depray endless blind metta. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind metta. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind metta. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.